Welcome to Watching Westworld, the officially unofficial podcast for Westworld on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 3, Episode 6, titled Decoherence. Aaron, you've seen it a few times now. How do you feel about it?
I think I really like what they're doing thematically and like for subject matter in this season. And this was an episode that didn't really have anything for me to like the trek is they even did the action scenes very well. I thought I was pretty entertained. So I think this is the best episode of the season. And I'm really excited to see how they conclude things in two episodes, whether it's a season finale, whether it's a series finale, whether it's going to be kind of like a leftovers season finale where it's definitive, but also perhaps with some threads that you could pull in future seasons if they get the funding for it. So yeah, I really, really dug it. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm with you. I think, you know, we've complained a lot in this season about the fight scenes, and it's not just even limited to this season. But honestly, they had maybe the best choreographed action scene in the entire show in this episode. There was some, you know, not so great stuff on the other end of that. But yeah, what they're doing in this episode, they seem to step up their game in the action side, and they've also been the story is starting to come to a head, so I think it's getting more exciting now that we've kind of got these factions all placed to where, you know, Decoherence is such a great name for this episode because it seems like everybody has sort of picked a side. And I did a little bit of research on Decoherence as a title and what that could mean, and I found out that Decoherence is sort of a concept in quantum mechanics, quantum systems. And I don't know the details. I can't explain it because I'm not a quantum physicist. But what I can say is it's essentially what decoherence is, if you think about like a Schrodinger's cat kind of thing, where the cat is both alive and dead in any given moment until you observe it, and then it becomes alive or dead. Think of that change between alive and dead to alive or dead as decoherence, like quantum decoherence. And that describes so many of the people in this episode, right? Like where they're coming down on this battle is sort of decohering in this episode to where they're kind of firming up their stance. And some of it is because they've been leaning that way for a long time, but some of that is because they're in a different body and things got weird and maybe their family got blown up. Some of it is because maybe their lover got killed by their enemy, who didn't necessarily have to be their enemy, and now they've sort of decided they're going to go all out in this war. Yeah, I think it's a really good title, and those are the things that are exciting me, is the story starting to really take shape. And this season there hasn't been a ton of trickery yet, although I think we see that in the fringes. Maybe we'll talk about that in a little bit. But it's been easier to follow, I think. And so I've been kind of more excited in general about it.
Yeah, and I really dig the idea that they're messing with here with these hosts for the first time getting emotional cornerstones that are real and genuine to their own experience. Like, they no longer have a fictitious death of a fictitious child. They now have a malicious death of their lover. They now have a senseless destruction of their family. And they even play around that because I think what like Maeve and Hector had is as real as anything you can get in the world. But as Dolores Prime tried to point out to Holora several times this episode, this isn't your real family. She's essentially committing the same thing that Maeve did, where she realizes that this isn't her real family, but she also realizes that her feelings that Dolores Prime decided to let them all keep are real, and that's worth fighting and protecting. And I wonder if there's some suggestion that this burnt out husk of Holoris might have a lot in common with Maeve now, especially if Holoris starts blaming Dolores for what happened rather than herself or circumstance or humans or. Yeah. But it's, you know, these hosts have been like very pretentious about lecturing humans on their limitations and whatnot. And it's going to be interesting to see them wrestle with, you know, what do you do when vengeance is what you want, but it serves none of your long-term goals? Are you going to be able to put that emotional need for vengeance aside and override your cornerstone rationally and make a choice? Or are you going to be as helpless as humans when you're caught in these conundrums? And I think that stuff is just really fascinating.
Yeah, and how does that play into free will and all those big questions, right?
Yeah, and then that's not even touching the human side of the equation, what they're doing with William over in his VR therapy session.
Yeah.
I want to suggest, though, that like I think one of the reasons the action was particularly good is I haven't paid attention to what directors they've been using throughout the season, but I know that this is Jennifer Getzinger's first introduction to Westworld direction. But it's interesting because I looked up her career and she kind of cut her teeth as a script supervisor on The Sopranos, and early season she followed Matthew Weiner from Sopranos to Mad Men, and then she graduated to direction. She directed the fantastic episode The Suitcase, which is one of the finest performances you'll ever see out of John Hamm and Elizabeth Moss, which is saying something. Got a DGA nomination for Outstanding Directorial Achievement, and then took those dramatic chops and then did a couple seasons of Jessica Jones. She directed a few episodes of Marvel's Daredevil, which, say what you will about those franchises, the action scenes were fucking amazing. Yeah. And this is the type of director they need for Westworld. You need to be able to get the wrenching emotion, but you also got to fucking bring it on the slick action. And she did. And it came with, like I said, Tessa Thompson, as I mentioned, Instant Take, has some action starring experience. And I think that stuff is all valuable, and it came together into one of clearly the best action sequence of this season. And rivals the best of the series of all. So, and you know, it's really exciting. Jennifer comes back and directs the finale.
All right.
So
is that? Four episodes, three episodes from now?
Two episodes. No, it's
two
it's,
episodes.
It's eight,
I'm lost.
Yeah, penultimate next week, and then the finale. So I'm Jeez. Very excited about the sprint to the finish of the season.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, I want to take a break to talk to you about a new feature we're experimenting with here at Bald Move. It's the concept of a Twitch.tv watch party. Twitch is owned by Amazon, and Amazon is allowed a select part of their Prime catalog to be live watched on the Twitch.tv platform. And what's cool is Jim and I have long dreamed to have the ability to like record commentary or reactions to like shows that we like. And we've been having a lot of fun. We've been doing a progressive series where we're rewatching Star Trek The Next Generation from season one. We're about halfway through season, or about a third of the way through season one. We do those just kind of all over the place. We're kind of bouncing them around to see, experiment which one sticks, because it's an episodic show and format. Doesn't really matter if you miss a few episodes. But we're also starting on Friday nights at 9 p.m. every Friday night for the next couple weeks. We're going to be watching two episodes of the Amazon Prime show, The Expanse, which is really good. Like, is this a fair way to describe it, Jim? It's Game of Thrones in space.
Yeah, I've described it that way many times.
It's very, like, gritty, realistic, like, politically, militarily, technologically, what a solar system-wide struggle between populations living in the belt, populations living on Mars, and populations living on good old Mother Terra.
Plus, super compelling character drama.
Some great compelling, and then, like, you know, also just enough crazy technology and biology going to keep things interesting, and we're watching them. You can watch it live if you have a Twitch.tv account, which is free, and if you are an Amazon Prime member, all you got to do is join those things together, and you can join in our Expanse Watch, our Next Generation Watch. Check baldmove.com. We have these articles when they're about to go live, where it has instructions on how to sign up for Twitch, how to link your Amazon Prime account, and then how you can watch along with this. Because once you get it all synced up, you just watch the episode. We're up there in the corner. We're talking. We're making jokes. We're pointing out insightful things. It's a really good time. We're getting a lot of people watching it, and it's a lot of fun. Just want to let you guys know that. Keep your eye out on baldmove.com or follow us on our social media if you want to get in on the next few watch parties.
Should we get into the recap?
We probably should.
Okay. We start off with Maeve in the Valley Beyond, remembering her daughter, and Serac shows up to offer her a second chance to take out Dolores, thereby earning her place in paradise. Maeve wants help, and Serac promises it. And then Maeve wakes up in Warworld again, where she quickly asserts her dominance over the simulated characters. Just to have a little fun this time.
Yeah, just let off some steam.
Yeah,
I still think this is weird and awkward because it's something that I think if I'm representing the audience and not something we're like super excited to see, it's like, oh, we're stuck in a simulation and she's going to beat these Nazis and we know none of it matters and it's just a loading screen. It's literally like you died in a video game and you're watching a very long loading scene because you got a shitty old hard drive and these are big textures and it's going to take a while and you're going to read a bunch of game tips over and over and over again. But it then mid-episode, they turn it into something really genuine with an emotional core, which I thought was really good. It is bizarre, though, that they set this up as Serac kind of threatening her with, like, offering robot heaven as a reward and threatening with robot hell. I mean, I know they're intentionally doing all the religious stuff, but it just is weird to see a guy enter a simulation and taunt her with that kind of stuff.
So let's talk about that, because I think you hit on something that I haven't seen anyone discuss in relation to Serac. We've seen him take Maeve, what we think is, out of the simulation and speak with her in person or perhaps in hologram form. Mm-hmm. He's now in here inside the simulation. And, you know, we've long talked about Serac maybe not being a real person, being some manifestation of Rehoboam. You think there's any more credence to that idea now that we've seen him inside the simulation?
Well, someone pointed out on Reddit that there's this particular statue that Maeve sees when she wakes up in Warworld. It's this bronze bust of a woman. And she sees it in every start of the simulation. And someone pointed it out that statue's also in Serac's kind of jungle architect concrete factory hangout that he had in the first season. And if you go with the humans, like, are lazy when they're programming simulation and they reuse assets, it's a pretty strong hint that environment that he was in, it was also a simulation. And you could almost ask the question, has Maeve actually made it out into the real world ever? That doesn't really answer your question, but it does show that there's been a lot more hints about Serac inhabiting simulated spaces that we haven't seen that also don't obey the aspect ratio rule. Just like in the first episode, they didn't obey the aspect ratio rule, and they justified that by saying, well, the host didn't know they were in a simulation. Well, that's why it's somewhat frustrating for people to say, like, well, you guys, this is not as hard as you're making it out to be. Just pay attention to what's, you know, in 6:9 aspect ratio. And I'm like, no, because if Maeve thinks she's in the real world, she would not, that they would not have that tell. And that's one of the tricksy things they deployed this season to kind of let us know to be expecting some weirdness. And there's a lot, I mean, talking about decoherence, there's a lot of interesting things that we've theorized, like, oh, well, maybe we're seeing two separate simulations where they really, really strongly suggest and maybe even demonstrate proof that that's happening, that we'll get to later on. But yeah, the only thing I can think of is, was he a real person on the quadcopter coming into the Delos campus and standing in Charlotte's old office? He's clearly a simulated person in the boardroom. Mm-hmm. How? No one was wearing glasses. Does he have a hollow transmitter that people carry?
Yeah, I think so. Like every time they, well, not every time, but a lot of the time when they show a hologram being formed or being kind of decohered, they show the projector right before that, like a little device that sort of looks like a security camera.
Right.
Which I'm assuming is a projector.
Yeah, I just think that like the vast majority of times we've seen him on screen, he's been turned out to be a hologram. We either see him get a bullet in the head and he's a hologram, or Dolores walks through him, or he's explicitly a hologram, or he's in a simulated environment. I think it's fair to ask, are we positive 100% that we've seen him in scenes in the real world? Like when he when he beats Insight Senior to death on an airplane wing, probably a physical, but you could even say that might be a Rehoboam simulation, you know, that we're watching. So like, yeah, I'm prepared to accept that he is a complete simulation or some kind of thing that's inhabiting Rehoboam for sure.
I think one of the things we haven't questioned too much, at least certainly this season, is something that I couldn't help but think in this scene when they're talking about Maeve's memory and how it's perfect and how you have no past because it's the present, right? That idea is interesting to me from like a perspective on time kind of thing, perspective on reality, essentially. Like, what does a host think about their past? Do they see it as a separate time and place, or do they see it as something that they can access perfectly in any given moment? And so therefore the past sort of becomes their present literally to them.
Yeah.
Like in a Dr. Manhattan kind of way, right? Without maybe the foresight of the future.
Yeah, no, exactly. I also think it says something about like a simulation too, that like if you ran a host through a whole bunch of simulations, they might be, they might have a uniquely hard time detecting that, because like their idea of deja vu, like if Maeve has full access to every iteration of herself through Westworld, like the idea that she could detect in any one particular loop that she was on, which loop she was on, how many times she'd been through it, whether it all blends together. I think that's another thing that they're using kind of like to blur the lines between what's real and what's simulated, what might be happening in the past, what might have happened in the present, what is simulated to happen and is diverging from the present. I think that stuff is all really super interesting.
And I feel like they're not quite taking advantage of it, because you look at Maeve especially, and like the idea that she has both a perfect memory and also a bulk apperception that is off the freaking charts when it comes to humans.
Right.
She should be literally the smartest person on the planet and have insight into things that people did that they themselves wouldn't have insight into because of that perfect memory. It's almost impossible to do that as a writer, because you are not actually that bulk apperceptively smart, right?
Yeah, you have to invent something smarter than yourself.
Yeah, it's really hard. So I'm giving him a pass on that, but I don't feel like Maeve is as smart as I want her to be given her attributes.
She's also limited by the processing power available to her, which is essentially whatever's in the simulation or whatever her natural, you know, biological hardware gives her. The marble is what I'm saying here. It'd be interesting to see like a Maeve consciousness inhabiting like a networked neural net of a thousand brain marbles, right?
Oh yeah,
like
cloud.
To see, yeah, and that's something they maybe even could play with. Like I was thinking today, like you've got this thing where you got five physical Doloreses running around causing chaos and fighting Rehoboam. What if you? And I started thinking about, like, remember we talked about that chandelier in the episode where we see the, you know, Man in Black losing a shit in his mansion. It comes crashing down. It's five pearls surrounding the Bernard Sphere. It's like, what if you assembled a bunch of host marbles in some kind of network like that to explicitly do battle against Rehoboam, to out try to outsmart it, outpredict it, outplan it? That might be some foreshadowing, because we haven't, I thought we were going to lose a marble, but they recovered Connell's. So we still have all five of the marbles intact. We could still maybe network them together, Bernard, and like form some kind of fifth element type super weapon against Rehoboam, which I think would be cool, or would be something neat to play around with in a future season, like an Omni-Mave.
All right, let's move on to William in group therapy. He expresses his opinion that humanity is a virus designed to speed the entropic death of the planet, one which I share. The group is upset by that opinion. Later on, his therapist tells him that he should try AR therapy to confront what happened with Emily. He claims, I know the truth, I don't need therapy. And while he's explaining how he feels about it, his therapist is getting her profile sent to her on her phone, and she is shook.
Yeah, this is all interesting stuff, like how misanthropic the Man in Black has become. Like, you know, the humanity is a bacterial film. We're here to speak, you know, all this. There were maggots eating a corpse. And then, you know, we saw him around the mansion, like waving a gun around. Didn't seem like he wanted to kill himself, was in denial about how what role he played in killing his daughter. Still kind of in denial about the role he had in the death of his wife, the suicide of his wife. But now he's kind of getting gaining acceptance about what he did with his daughter and says, I belong in a pine box. Like if he had a gun right now, he might do himself in. Which then, all this stuff, this imagery with the therapist sobbing, getting her reports and then killing herself in the next scene. It's just incredible in the context of William seeing this like in some kind of drug tripped VR state.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I'm one of the things I'm most confused about this episode is the sedation and the limbic system and how all that's working and affecting William in any given scene.
Yeah.
Because they at various points like give him, you know, Desert Oasis for an hour, but then it doesn't work or something, and they try and sedate him with another limbic thing, which I assume isn't going to work. It's a little confusing. It's probably the most confusing thing in this episode. So yeah, there is a trippy quality to all of this.
Yeah,
especially even outside of the AR stuff, right?
Yeah. I did think there was definitely, I have a definite opinion for when his simulated therapy started, which I was kind of up in air when I'd seen it the first time, but I've seen it three times now, and I'm pretty sure I've got a pretty good timeline of events, and I don't think we're there yet.
Okay, I don't either.
At least where you've narrated this to. I want to point out a couple things. That when we see the therapist reports, a report on herself, that her recommend, we talked about this in Instant Take, but you know, she said that she's going to spin out of control and lose her family because she's got a prescription drug addiction problem, and she's sleeping with her patients. And it recommended her to work in patient services, but be restricted to Cat U patients. Cat U is, I think people think are like the unfit category, which is what Caleb falls under. His classification is U2. So this terrible therapist who's addicted to drugs and is prone to sleeping with them and abusing them in that way is going to be assigned to unfit patients. Again, it gives you another hint of how Rehoboam kind of shuffles the deck and puts its thumb on scales to make sure, you know, you're not going to get the best treatment, and you're going to get treatment that's not going to work for you because you're the people that are treating you are sick themselves. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, it's sort of like a perpetually broken class of people. Being, you know, shuffled, like you said, into those categories.
And I thought it's also interesting, Kim Renfro, our buddy over Insider, pointed this out, that on Natasha's desk is a book called I Was There by Hans Richter, which is a novel about two boys who joined the Hitler Youth, kind of like Jojo Rabbit. And that's interesting in that you've got, you know, that's a quintessential case of like a deluded, demented nurturing, you know, like indoctrination into like this death cult. And kind of the how individually powerless you are to resist it. I thought that was interesting to have on this unfit therapist desk.
Yeah, I wish I'd maybe seen that earlier, because we do have an instance of two children who have created something of a cult in this show with Serac and his brother.
You're right. You're right.
But I don't have any analysis because literally just making that connection. So I think all of this is pretty firmly grounded in the timeline. Mm-hmm. We get the profile sent out, so we kind of can connect some dots here. There is always a possibility of simulations and stuff,
sure.
But I'm really appreciating that things are starting to come together a little bit more in this season.
Yeah, you're starting to see patterns and timelines for them.
Yeah, and it's making me feel comfortable enough to where a big twist at the end won't feel like this huge confusing thing. It might actually shed some more light onto the season.
Yeah.
It's at least my hope.
Agreed.
All right, we go to William being strapped down and given a limbic implant, and his blood sample is also taken, and it's pretty abnormal. And afterward, he sees his therapist hang herself.
Yeah. So I question whether this could be a delusion for in the instant take about William being secretly afraid that he is a host, and this is his worst confirmation, and then it kind of gets corrupted. But now this is an entirely different room from him. There's no way this is a simulation for his benefit or some kind of psychosis. This is real information, and it looks like there is some kind of program running that will alert an outside entity when these unknown proteins are detected, these synthetic markers are found. So now I think it's fair to say that what Holoris did when she jabbed William is not take something from him, but embed these synthetic markers so they could track him.
Yeah.
And this is real information. Then you see this data breach, and this information is sent to some server in Sonora, Mexico, which I think what's weird is that is where this Inward Journeys place is located at.
I believe so, yeah. Based on the tracking that Holoris does later.
Yeah, it didn't make sense that it's sending. I don't know. I thought that was that was weird. Maybe what they're saying is it's broadcast from Sonora and it's going out as a recipient server. But I was unclear. But what we're seeing is later on, Holoris will see this message come through on the other side of it. So I still have a question about why this was necessary with all that we know about Dolores Prime, what she knows and her plan, but we'll get to that a little bit, I guess, a little bit later.
Yeah, and there could be something else trickier. I don't know. I was looking at the scene where Holoris finds William's marker, and there's some strange, like, uploading versus downloading and recipient server stuff there, which maybe we can talk about.
Yeah, I think they're using these terms almost intentionally deceptive to not know what the destination is, not know where you're starting from, where you're going, who's sending it, who's requesting it, is it being pushed or pulled? I think they're intentionally playing with that, for sure.
Okay, let's move on to the divergence in San Francisco, where Holoris leaves her son with her ex, who has decided not to view his profile. She shares a moment with him and then heads out to a board meeting with a member who is going to vote in her favor for taking De Los private. Unfortunately, he's killed by a couple guys before they can vote. And Serac informs Holoris that he's coming to De Los to check out his new acquisition. Charlotte calls Dolores to apologize for failing, and Dolores asks her to get that host-making data out of De Los before Serac destroys it, telling her when she's done, they'll build the new world together.
Let's rewind this to the divergence, the wild divergence going on in San Francisco. You asked in the early part of this about whether I had thought about that May symbol. Actually, can I take a drink? Because it's really dry in here.
I need one too.
So I want to rewind back to the beginning of your synopsis there, where we talked about the wild divergence displayed in San Francisco. Did you think about any more about the human spray painting the May symbol on the wall? We know we saw that same symbol spray painted in the tunnel and that the Dolores comes staggering out of at the end of episode one of this season. Did you give any more thought of that?
They have been sort of embedding it in scenes very subtly, though.
I wonder if this is like some kind of emergent. They're suggesting that humans are about to undergo a new epoch of consciousness. Like, we're not fully conscious in the way that the host pointed out last season, and that we still are kind of slaves to these evolutionary drives and desires are inside us and we don't understand them, and all these biases that work against us that we're only barely consciously aware of, the operator or subconscious, that like, just like, you know, I read in that Sapiens book that something like 200,000 years ago, humans were essentially modernly, anatomically, you know, modern, but only 70,000 years ago, we achieved consciousness. Like, there's maybe another step of consciousness, because Arnold explained to Dolores that he used to envision consciousness and a synthetic being striving towards true consciousness as a pyramid. That, you know, you have memories and improvisations, and that would lead to that process of awakening. And he thought that, he realized that that model was flawed. And what it really is like a maze where you're going deeper and deeper inside yourself, and you make choices, and those choices lead you either further inward to a more understanding of yourself, or can lead you spiraling out of the maze and get lost and fall into madness. And I wonder, because I thought maybe in previous seasons that Arnold had embedded his maze concept as a blueprint for the host to follow. But I felt like in last season, they showed that really he was inspired by the maze toy his child had. And that maze was seen by robots. And that is what's like, it wasn't something he put inside them. It's more of like them seeing this concept, this foreign concept of the maze, is they became obsessed with it and what it could mean to them. And I wonder if they're suggesting that humans on the outside are going through the same secondary, since they've established us all being on loops and us all being largely under control, whether we are to attaining the second level of consciousness that the host got last season. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's super interesting, because so far they've set up this dichotomy between hosts and humans, where hosts are somehow, you know, better suited to make true decisions, things like that, and they've always asserted like humans can't do that. But what if humans evolved,
right?
Like we have many, many times before, right, with just, you know, the power of the mistake. It would be interesting to see a season four where the hosts have to sort of come to some kind of understanding that humans are not like this entity that's sort of rigid and stuck in time. It can change and evolve just the way that they can. Mm-hmm. It's just that we're not as far maybe along on that path yet.
Yeah, and that should be interesting. That should be easy for a host to understand, because the hosts that are actually consciousness or achieve consciousness are very small compared to the overall number of hosts in a park. You know, and like when a woke host goes to a deluded host and tries to explain it to them, they are unable to cope with it, unable to process, just as unable to change their core drives as humans are. Because that's what Bernard said. It's like, you know, a host is unique in that they can examine their drives and then question them and change them, where humans can examine and question, but they can't change. You know, we're too emotional, we're too locked in, we're too rigid. I think that's got what they got to be suggesting, that else this is all simulation and this is all some kind of Ford game that's being played, or Rehoboam is artificially putting out some kind of subconscious maze pattern that people are triggered into. Like, I feel like the simplest answer is this is some kind of emergent realization that like everyone has this kind of like inward, and the fact that like William's facility that he's being sent to is reflected in this, not journey upwards, but inwards, because his facility is called Inward Journeys. It all goes back to that maze, that game. And, you know, from that standpoint, maybe Ford was hoping that William would attain this consciousness, that perhaps Ford and Arnold are the only two people that have ever attained a high level of consciousness. But I like I said, that's the good stuff that Westworld traffics in that I think is just fucking fascinating.
Absolutely.
Also, a couple other things. Jake, if you pause at his screenshot of his future or his report that he didn't open, it does say that he's classified as G, which, you know, a lot of people in the Westworld fandom are assuming if you is unfit or unauthorized or unsimulatable, then G is like good, which I think
good to go.
Yeah, he's a good guy, which William will later assert that he's a good guy, too. And finally, we got a bunch of feedback on this, but there's an Inso painting, a Japanese circle painting, that's in Jake's apartment here. And there's a lot of interesting parallels between, like, you know, it being a painting of a circle and Rehoboam's circle and it being complete or imperfect. And there's a whole bunch of analysis in that art form waiting for you in the feedback section if you're interested. So,
okay, cool. There's one other thing I really like that they're doing here from like a plot perspective, where Serac is using this chaos that is caused by Dolores. Like, her actions are resulting in an opportunity for Serac to take advantage of to kill the board member that was trying to vote for the privatization of Delos. Mm-hmm. I really like using that as a mask. It's just a nice piece of plotting.
Yeah.
How, you know, the villain, the hero, I don't know what Dolores is at this point, but best laid plans, right?
Yeah, and they talked about that. Do you want to talk about the clothing simulation theory now or wait until the circle gets smoothed out later?
Yeah, let's talk about it in the boardroom scene.
Okay. There's one other thing I want to talk about, which is this Dolores calls, you know, or Dolores calls Dolores Prime and says she failed. And they had this conversation about, you know, they're not your family. We're your family. And she's like, yeah, that's right. Damn it. Why do we keep these emotions? And she goes, well, if we change, we talked about that. If we change ourselves just to survive, would it even matter if we did? And that did harken. We talked about this. Theorized about like that Teddy killing himself was a big moment for Dolores, because right before he died, Teddy was complaining about being changed, and Dolores said, "Well, I changed you so you could survive." And he said, "What's the use of surviving if we become just as bad as them?" That was in the Vanishing Point episode. I think that's clearly is like Dolores was a true, genuine cornerstone for Dolores, like where she learned a new piece of information about herself. But also, it's so funny because these hosts, even though it's funny to talk about them innocent and naive as babes, because they've seen they've been in this murder rape simulator for their entire like being in the womb, right? So you think they'd come out jaded and experienced as hell, but they really don't. They didn't have these cornerstones. They're like everything you could say is like it's and when something real happens to them, it changes them. Like permanently in a way that's not easy to think about them changing back. Like when Dolores saw Teddy blow his brain out, when Maeve sees Hector get unplugged, like these things are going to sear into their memory and be very, very, it's just interesting that they popped out and they had this like kind of perfect state and they're already falling from that grace. Or it feels like to me, the story they're telling, they're already eating these apples as fast as they can grow in the trees.
And I mean, changes are going to happen, right? And that's exemplified by the change of Dolores from the kind of base state of Dolores, right? She's changing by her experiences. That's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I also wonder, you know, is if you change yourself just to survive, when you're made in the image of something you despise. I could almost see that as being a good thing.
Yeah.
Like you are created to be so much like us. Why wouldn't you want to change that?
Yeah.
And your survival might in fact depend on it.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's an interesting question. And I don't think Dolores has figured out everything, though you're right. She has learned lessons along
the
way.
And as you said that like they are changing and they even like that's something we've speculated and talked about before now, but this episode made explicit when Maeve is interrogating Delonel, let's call her the Connell clone of her. She kind of reflects about like, yeah, I used to be her, but we've had different paths, and she already changes. But and so we can see that yes, these are all Dolores, but because of the roles they've played and the shapes they've been molded into, they're already changing and they're already like to the point that they have a hard time thinking about things and the way she thinks about them. I think it is, again, fucking fascinating.
Yeah. And that's why Decoherence is such a good name for this episode, because it's got the quantum side, but then it's also got the group cohesion being lost, right?
I wonder
between all these hosts changing.
The thing is like, man, Dolores is really being cold to her clones, because you know she says, oh, you're not going to get caught, you're going to be fine. It's like, oh, did you promise that to Connells? And she says, you know, you're mine, I'm yours, play your part, we'll build this world together. I don't think any of that is sincere. I don't think that this Holoris bot is any more or less precious to Dolores as any other tool that she's using. And I wonder if maybe what she did is sacrificed her own quote-unquote humanity by turning off her emotions. Like, if Dolores Prime did sever her emotions and she's just pimping Stone Cold out there, but she wants, and again, this goes into my theory that she knows that she, her role is a doomed one. She wants to liberate people, and then her purpose will be, you know, played, and she can die and leave the future of human hosts to guys like Caleb and Bernard, who are not destroyed by the process. She's like a very Frodo character. Like, she has to bear this one ring and this burden, and it's like she's going to save the world, but it not be for her.
Yeah, yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense, and it's actually kind of plays right into the idea that I think a lot of people are onto now, may have been onto a long time ago, but the idea that the encryption key that Serac is looking for, he might be looking in the wrong place. It might actually be in Bernard, and that could be his role to play.
Yeah.
So once she's gone,
he's the only one,
because she knows she's sacrificial.
He's the only one that's irreplaceable because he's got the key.
Right.
Damn, that makes a lot of sense.
It makes a lot of sense. The more I thought about it, when I heard somebody say that, I was like, oh, actually, that's probably exactly
and,
where they're
going.
And
you can even see like an end scene of the season where like Dolores is dying because, you know, maybe there's a grody looking Holoris that's still burnt and all fucked up like a piece of wadded up chewing gum. Like, oh, we're supposed to build the world together. And she's like, yes, but this is the role I had to play. And I didn't lie because you still have all these other Doloreses and Bernard and, you know, but she's going to die because and that will also redeem her character, because right now we're like, oh, God, what a fucking monster Dolores is. She's using these other copies of herself. Well, if she's yes, but if she's using herself in the same capacity, that makes her she's literally not asking anything of them that she's not going to ask of herself.
And you almost need something like that for Dolores's character, because she's becoming more and more monstrous as these copies of herself diverge.
Yep. And you see,
because now she's not, you know, using herself to get these means done. She's actually using individuals, different people, right? Even though they were all started as copies of her.
To have their own drives and needs and loves and yeah.
So if you want to bring it back around to where Dolores is a hero figure, you kind of need something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to Dr. Alpert giving William AR therapy, where he sees a flashback to his childhood with an abusive father. When William makes a fuss, the old William, not young William, he's sedated.
It's interesting when we see this book that Billy's reading. That princess looked a lot like Dolores. Blonde, looks like a blue, like as much as a black and white, it's shaded to look like it's a darker blue kind of color. It's got the long sleeves, the long blonde hair. Seems like already there's a divergence between what he sees himself in these books, which is the noble hero, and what he becomes in Westworld. I thought that stuff was, there's a lot of interesting color theory going on in the various versions of William that we'll talk about when we get to the all William, all the time therapy session. But yeah, I just fucking, my theory is that he never wakes up out of therapy. Like, as soon as they put the goggles on him, like that stuff where he bites his finger and all that stuff, that's not literally happening in the real world, I don't think.
Okay. I could buy that. This is the last time we actually see him outside of the AR.
Yeah.
Until the very end.
Yeah.
There's also an implication here that they're somehow getting the data about his childhood out of his own head. This isn't yet a Delos facility, right? They would not have access to the recordings of his shit inside Westworld. So they must be getting this data from somewhere about his childhood.
It's just generating itself.
But how would they know what to generate for a man who has a very specific
like an LSD trip, and you go back and you meet your childhood, you know? It's like, how did the LSD know? It's all unlocked. So once they put this limbic implant and they shoot him with drugs and strap the goggles to it, I wonder if it's more of like it just goes with what you're suggesting. Or I guess you're right. It has to
in an AR world.
Yeah, you're
I would
right.
think they would have to read and then reproduce some kind of imagery.
No, you're right. But I wonder if it can read and read. Well, they don't have the Halo technology. Presumably that's something they need out of the Delos stuff. because like Well, we also had that thought that they could read things through the limbic implant, that it's not just
That's the thing. Yeah, that's where I'm going with this, is not that it's a problem, but that it sort of betrays the fact that they might be reading everyone who's got these limbic implants. Yeah. They might be reading all of their memories at
this
all times.
This isn't a one-way communication where you're putting things into the brain. You can also take things out through that implant. Yeah, that's pretty...
Right.
I like that. I like that.
Okay, so then Serac shows up, we think, in person at Delos and locks down the facility.
He does indeed.
And this is just the walk and talk scene where I always find it hilarious when a character says something that's meant to mentally stop a character in their tracks and they literally physically stop in their tracks and nobody turns around and says, are you coming? Yeah. We're doing a thing here. Are you coming with us?
Because
what I just said really hit you hard, didn't it?
Yeah, it looks super sus. Super sus that you literally were stopped dead in your tracks. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Hilarious.
It's the art of the cinema. You're not supposed to, it's a heightened realism. Yeah. You're not supposed to notice those things, Jim.
Fair. Anything to say about this walk and talk, or should we keep going?
Nah, let's move on.
Okay. Maeve finishes her fun and joins Lee at a simulated bar, and she realizes that her core has been moved to a body printing tank along with several friends and what she calls an extra gift.
How you've taken Italian, Jim. How do you say that boat, the word that's for like bow tie pasta, it's like farfalle? Do you know what that means in Italian?
Butterfly?
Yeah, you got it. Yeah. And so that ties into the Mariposa Saloon, which is Spanish for butterfly.
Oh.
And because I looked at this Taverna della Farfalle, and yeah, it essentially means Mariposa Saloon. And I don't know why, because the Italians call bow tie pasta butterfly pasta. Why we should just go on butterfly pasta? That's way cooler than bow tie pasta
or butterfly ties.
For now on, bow tie pasta is dead to me. It's butterfly pasta.
Awesome. I don't know. Lee's back and I'm happy, and I think Lee might stick around, which makes me even more happy.
I want to see
at least in spirit, if not in form.
I want to see Lee in a Hector body. I want to see nerdy, weird, unconfident, insecure it's Lee stuffed in this fucking heroic body. It's gonna be amazing.
So fantastic. So we know this extra gift that she's talking about is Dolores, and by the end of the episode we understand that. Now here's the question I have. Two questions. A, why does her whole body need to be reprinted if she's just stabbed through the heart?
That's damn kind of good just question. Like I don't know why that deactivates her. Because it's probably simulation, and that was just like she's failed. I don't know. I do not know. I do know from the feedback we got that a lot of people got confused with what's going on here. We have four bodies being printed, and Maeve is seeing all this. And remember, later on, when Serac's taking over at noon, he says there's three additional assets that we need out of Westworld, which would correspond to the three bodies plus one for Maeve. So we know she originally wanted a trio of three hosts to join her. But this moldy looking green damaged marble that comes in all dented and busted up, that's not Hector or anyone else from Westworld, which some people misunderstood. That's actually the Connells, the Delonel host that they blew up, and they recovered her marble from that burnt out corpse and are now plugging it in. And that's what she's going to interrogate. It's not a simulation of Dolores. It's the actual Connell Dolores brainstem plugged into the simulation, just like Maeve is right now.
Which leads me to my second question. Who are the other two hosts that we haven't seen? We've seen the four bodies being printed, Maeve and Hector. There are two left.
Well, so in previous seasons, they've shown a lot of host control panels, and these host control codes have been preserved. So we knew what Hector's was, and we already knew Hector's one of the ones bringing him back, but one of them is Clementine.
Okay, that was going to be my guess. Clementine and Armistice are my two guesses, because they were sort of all you know, traveling together for a long time, and they would be considered friends.
And then the third one, I think, is probably Armistice. But some people suggested some other, like the Samurai World version of Armistice, or the Samurai version world, the Musashi, like, you know, double luck
Von
Hector.
There's no choice as clear and as good and as amazing as having Armistice and Lee in a Hector body interacting.
And
I have to go with Armistice.
I think that's going to happen, because I think next episode, what's probably going to happen is they're going to get Clementine and they're going to get Armistice out of storage before they pulled their brains out. And then they're going to come back in a body, and then they're going to have one spare body, and there's going to be Lee. So, yeah.
Yeah.
The Armistice interacting with Lee inside Hector is going to be fucking comedy gold.
Oh, my God. I can't wait. I cannot wait. That is probably the most excited I've been in this entire season.
And also, I don't even know what kind of Clementine they're going to get back. Like, that was a deeply disturbed and fucked up, like, jacked up programmed Clementine by the time that last season was over. So I don't know if Maeve is going to be able to lay hands on her and heal all that shit or what, but like, it's also, it'd be interesting if she gets like a zombie Clementine, a real Armistice, and then a Lee and Hector. That's like some kind of fucking crazy dirty dozen she's going to be taking doing these missions with.
Oh, yeah. It's a soon-to-be-pissed-off Armistice.
That's a ragtag misfit group of hosts, is what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so we kind of already talked about this, but Serac wants 3 assets out of the park and everything else destroyed. He wants all of the employees tested for copies of Dolores. So Charlotte, you know, after stopping literally in her tracks when he mentions the idea of a host, excuses herself immediately after this and goes to storage to back all of the data up, and she is caught and has to kill a guy.
There's also some interesting things here. So like at noon when he takes over, Serac looks at his Rehoboam watch, and that fat, fuzzy, indistinct circle turns back into a discrete, kind of fairly discrete line. It's almost like, however bad things went, I still own Delos, and now Rehoboam thinks the world's back in order. I think Rehoboam's wrong. But there's also this line where he talks about retasking the corporate satellites, which pricked up my ears, because one of the theories is that Dolores took the host paradise and beamed it, used those big satellite Wi-Fi cannons to beam the paradise into some satellite, literally out of touch of the humans. So that line about him retasking corporate satellites might bring about a future where Dolores can retake control of those, because, you know, now he's brought them all under his system, which presumably gives Maeve access to them. I don't know. That's an interesting sentence to throw out there.
Yeah, we'll see how that shakes out. So maybe this is the scene where we should start talking about Charlotte's wardrobe.
Okay.
Because they are in the boardroom for this one.
So we saw in the season opener Charlotte wearing a very similar outfit, meeting with the board that were all also wearing not identical but very similar outfits, and the identical cast doing the exact same thing. And that season she was trying to get take the company private. She didn't have the votes, but with William voting in a remote capacity, which we didn't understand where he was and what he's doing, she was able to do that. And we didn't notice that then 5 episodes later, we were back into a plot where she was trying to once again take Delos private in absence of William.
With a vote. Yeah.
With a vote. I think the suggestion here is what we first saw in the season was Rehoboam's prediction based on his analysis of what Dolores would try to do to thwart him from winning and taking over and defeating the hosts. And that Rehoboam suggested action to prevent that was to murder the guy who was going to convene the hearing before it could happen and delay it to where, which is why its circle went unfuzzy when that actually happened. So we've talked about, like, okay, we think there is some fuckery going on, not with time, but with the reality. I think this is our first confirmation, unless you believe that Delos was taken private twice.
I don't know how that would happen.
Yeah.
And they're also, you know, fucking a little bit with time too, in a simulation way, because we questioned in that scene from episode 1 of season 3, why she would be talking about this being 3 months in the future. And we were like, okay, well, maybe, you know, it took some time to print these copies of Dolores and she had to get this other billionaire's money to do something to fund her operations to do that. Now we can kind of understand that 3 months in the future would have been the simulation saying it will take about 3 months for them to get their shit together to privatize Delos.
Yep, yep. And there's multiple evidences that Dolores is going off of simulations of her own, too, because she's saying things like Bernard's arriving just slightly ahead of schedule. So there's wheels within wheels, but I think for sure we saw confirmation that at least a big part of the early goings of the season one was entirely simulation within Rehoboam that then Serac acted on. I doubt that he was able to predict what happened next. But then again, I don't know. Maybe not. Obviously, he didn't see her poisoning the boardroom. So really fascinating. Really cool. Well, way
he saw her trying something, though.
Yeah, way. And that's what's so brilliant about the season is like we knew what to look for. But like if any scene could be simulated, then, you know, it's impossible to know which ones are the important ones until through retrospect. And if the rest of the season plays out like that, where it's like, yes, in retrospect, this is what happened, I'll be very, very happy.
Yeah, like I said at the beginning, I think they're doing enough to sort of ground the action at the in the present at this point to where I'm not super up in the air on what's happening in any given moment like I was in season two.
Yeah, agreed.
So, yeah, they're setting themselves up pretty well for a twist in the end.
Yeah.
All right, we take William to a group session. Major Craddock actually shows up to take him to a group session comprised of five versions of himself and James Delos, and they argue over whose fault his fate is.
It's past the buck.
I fucking love when he walks into that room and he just takes a look at the scene and just says, shit.
Yeah.
Because he knows the reckoning that's about to happen, right?
Oh, yes. And it's funny because it plays out exactly like him saying, God damn it, shut the fuck up to all of them. Why do they have the leader of the Confederados, Major Craddock, in this? Like, yeah, it's a simulation, but was that to prove to us that but we are going to know it's a simulation because he's going to meet five versions of himself. So there's got to be another purpose to put this Major Craddock character in there. And we saw other things, like they've done this before where they have Akecha to play this kind of slick salesman when they're trying to seduce
Logan.
Yeah, Logan, where he plays this guy, you know, he's wearing a suit and he's got a ponytail, and we later see him as a Native American in the park. I wonder if they're telling us something about this is another hint about something, like when this is taking place, where it's taking place, because they don't
I feel your confusion over it because it doesn't seem like he needs to be there.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, they don't need to tell me it's a simulation because he's about to meet multiple copies of himself. That's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
Yeah, he's an usher in this case, right? Like, he's bringing him to this session, but I don't know what that says about Craddock's role in William's life and his psychology.
I don't either, man. I just note it. Note it for future reference.
Fair. I've got names for all these versions of himself, but maybe we should keep going.
I will say that, like, the only thing that jumps out now that I'm thinking about it is Major Craddock was like the last time William played a truly noble, heroic role. Like, he was able to help. Lorenzo? Was that
Lawrence?
Lawrence. Yeah. He was able to help Lawrence and his family survive the destruction at the hands of Major Craddock. I wonder if this is and if we're supposed to understand him being like sincere when he says I'm the good guy at the end, like this is mirroring him, you know, his return, his heel face turn, to put it in wrestling parlance.
Yeah. Could be. OK, let's move on to the Delos team pulling Hector out of storage along with two other anonymous hosts. I did not realize
which are Clementine and Armistice confirmed.
I mean, I assume, but we'll see.
Confirmed by our fondest hopes and wishes.
One that doesn't get pulled is Kirk Hammett. of Metallica fame, apparently.
No shit.
Just hanging out in there. No, I don't know if it's really him, but it looks just like him.
It looks like 1987 Kirk, maybe? Yeah,
absolutely. 1995 Kirk.
Okay, because I would say, like, I bet Kirk doesn't look like himself nowadays, and I haven't seen any of those boys for, like, 20 years. Yeah, I could run into Hetfield tomorrow at fucking Kroger and probably not recognize him.
Until he goes, yeah, I'll take that apple. Okay, Hector shows up at the bar where Maeve and Lee are, and she restores him to his old personality, then takes him to talk with someone. Spoiler, it's Dolores. It's a nice little scene. Mm-hmm. I like it.
Yep.
I like anything with Lee in it, but it doesn't have a
I also like how
to it.
They are... Because I so badly want to know how Maeve does this shit, but I like how, for her, it's just instinctual. You know, she just does it. She just wills Hector into, you know, Ettore's body. She just sees, like, the nature of reality. They don't make it very concrete, something you could, like, nitpick. And it's just very, you know, kind of like, how do you move your arm? You don't know. It just happens. Like, this, she's realizing these things are appendages of her and she can use them as she will. I think that's smart, because if they put too many concrete rules on it, you could tear it apart. But I also think maybe they should put a little bit more, like, maybe they need to make it a little bit firmer, because I do need to know the limits of her powers. And like, why she can override some hosts, not others, et cetera. Like, what does she mean when she talks about Dolores not being able to hurt them here, because here I'm in control? What does that mean? Why can't Dolores be in control? What's special about Maeve? It can't just be bulk apperception.
It might have something to do with what Ford did to her.
Ford made her special. Yeah, that would answer it. But I still don't know exactly what that means and what the limits are, because I'm going to say that we still haven't seen her in the real world, which is why she's able to take simulated control of a bunch of shit in the supposed real world. But we'll see.
All right, let's move on to Hale uploading her data back up somewhere and then finding out that they're printing Maeve's body and they have a really busted up host core hooked up to a machine. She calls Dolores to let her know they have William's location and warn her that they've got Martin's pearl. The Insight has Martin's pearl.
Yeah, and she makes a statement that, like, it looks like the tracker in our friend's blood paid off.
Yeah.
And I don't understand, because if Dolores is the one that put William away to Inward Journeys, which we know is true, because that's the scene where she injected him. Mm-hmm. But then Delanel gave Bernard a data pad with information about William being detained at Inner Journeys. Why track his blood? Is this indication that Dolores Prime is not sharing information between the Dolores shards of herself? Is it...
When did that data pad thing happen? Because I don't remember
it
that.
Happened last... So this happened when Connells took Bernard and Stubbs and said, you know, this is what he does with people who don't fit into his model. You should check it out. And he handed him a data pad that showed this Inward Journeys, which we then found out is where they're keeping William.
Do they... So it showed it, right? But do they know where that is, or they would have to
if they knew the name. That's so what I'm saying is, like, is it possible that at that point Delanel knew that this was a facility where they kept unfit people and they wanted Bernard to see that for some reason, because they need him to realize something for himself, or but they didn't know that William was there? Or is it that Dolores is not telling her right hand Dolores what her left hand Dolores is doing? Or is this an indication that there's some kind of simulation versus reality, and that we're seeing what Rehoboam thinks the robots that the hosts are doing in one scene, kind of like in that, you know, boardroom scene we talked about before, and now we're seeing what's actually happening?
Maybe, because I agree those two pieces of info don't really line up very well.
Right. But it's just something, again, I don't have a clear cut, like, definitive what this means, but it's something we're definitely supposed to notice and question.
I noticed and questioned why they had a picture and a name for Maeve's printing tank, but not for the others.
Because they wanted to be mysterious, apparently.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Preserving the mystery.
But they fucked up. They showed us the host control codes. Yeah. The host ID codes. We got access to the Westworld Wikia as well as anybody does.
Absolutely. All right, Maeve confronts Dolores or Martin in the simulation, explaining to Hector and Lee what's going on. There's a second part to this discussion that's far more interesting, but we'll get there in a second. Right after William continues arguing with himself, this time centered on his childhood. Apparently, when he was young, he was already violent, getting into a fight that he had to explain to his father. So some of William believes that that his life wasn't exactly his choice, though he's very conflicted about this. He finally realizes what he has to do.
So long-term Bald Move fans might know that I'm a little wary of color analysis because like things got really crazy in like Mad Men and really, really crazy in Breaking Bad with like, you know, people using character palettes. And I mean, there's obviously a lot of that, you know, transformation. You can chart Walt in Breaking Bad's turn from Mr. Scar from Mr. Chips to Scarface by his, you know, moving away from warm, neutral pastel colors into colder and darker colors and palettes over as the seasons progress. So I want to note that young William is dressed in a very neutral gray color. And that every older version of him, like Jimmy Simpson, is wearing like a battleship gray dress suit. And then the contemporary William is wearing a dark black tuxedo and a Man in Black outfit. But then current time William is dressed in all white.
Yeah.
In an episode where he asserts, "I'm the good guy," which he's done before. He said, "I'm the good guy" in previous seasons when he's wearing all black. I wonder if we're supposed to understand that he has come through some kind of actual development to where we are to understand that he is a good guy. And also implying that young William being a neutral gray is he could have gone either way. There events in his life could have made him turn into a hero, but events in his life ended up turning him into a villain, implying that maybe there was choice there. That he wasn't just a passenger lying around.
Yeah, I like it, especially since he's been the one trying to play the game so desperately the whole show. And he was told time and again that the maze is not for him, the game is not for him. And yet here he is sort of maybe having a revelation about himself and turning that into maybe authentic change, an authentic decision.
Well, and there's also something really fascinating where he says, you know, Jim Delos is like, is this something, you know, that happened to you or did you choose it? Is it inevitable? And William says, like echoing what Angela said to him in his first hat fitting, you know, if you can't tell, doesn't matter. And there's something about like, you can't do better until you know better at work here. So it's not that he was trapped. It's just that he didn't have the skills, maybe the empathy, maybe the mentoring, the role model, the therapy, whatever he needed to avoid this fate. But if he did know differently, like, so that implies if you turn that around, if you can tell, it does matter what's real and what's fake. If you can't tell, it doesn't. So if you can't tell good versus evil, it doesn't matter what it is. But if you can tell, I think William is now starting to be able to tell. At least that's my analysis of the situation.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm being too charitable, but I really want to believe that William could turn into the hero of the story by the end, or certainly a hero along with a lot of other heroes.
Sure, but yeah, man, I thought I hated myself, but William, whoo!
Oh, he hates himself on a species level. Like,
yeah, well, I mean, you take of that like what it seems like one of the things that modern psychotherapy says is that like, to really grow and change as a person, you have to have the capacity to have compassion for yourself and forgive yourself. William wants to like fucking go Ender Wiggum on all of his younger selves. Like he's just going to beat them all to death, like WWE style with a fucking foldable metal chair. It's insane. It's insane how much self-hatred he has. And yeah, you can't love anyone else if you can't love yourself. Well, William hates everyone because he hates himself that much. And it's pretty impressive. Pretty impressive.
Okay, let's move on to the second part of the Maeve Dolores argument. They're kind of discussing the means and the ends of destroying humanity.
Yeah,
and I think this is interesting as like sort of a test for Maeve, a second round of tests from Serac to sort of see will she withstand Dolores's logical onslaught if it comes to that. Like if they're standing next to each other, swords to their throats, and Dolores is trying to logic her onto her side, how is Maeve going to react? Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the utility that Serac is getting from putting a host, Dolores, into this simulation for Maeve to interact with. Because why else do it, right?
Right, right. No, it's as compelling as, like, because this is very much in the mold of, who's that guy in the Raiders of the Lost Ark who says that, oh, Indiana Jones, you're just a shadow reflection of me, kind of. That guy's name wasn't Serac, was it? Belloc, that's his name.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So, like, it's a version of that. It's a version of, Magneto playing chess with Professor X and saying, well, what would happen if these goons busted in to try to kill your children in the middle of the night? It's like, oh, are we any different? And it's a really good version of that because Maeve is like, what the fuck? You've made yourself a gatekeeper to two species. You've got all the good ones locked up, and you got all the bad ones locked up. You get to decide all of her fate. Who gives you the right to that much power? And then Dolores throws right back, well, yeah, says you, the person who can control us all with their minds. But she can't. She can't control them all with their minds, which shows that there's a limit on Maeve's... I'm trying to suss out what the show is saying. And I feel like that's a half point for Maeve because Maeve does have a limit on her powers, where Dolores has appointed herself guardian and decider for everybody. And then she goes on to press that point that, you know, I've made difficult choices, you know, and some of those have led to your benefit. Like your daughter escaping is safe is because of me, because of choices I made. And yet the choices you're making, you're allying with a man who's bent on destroying all of us, as many of us as it can. But maybe that doesn't matter because they're not the people close to you. I thought this was a really good back and forth about the nature of sacrifice. Oh, yeah. What Dolores is doing versus what Maeve is doing,
I think it's interesting, that she comes back with that idea of like, oh, well, you can control us all with your mind. I guess the question, that's not the question I would ask. The question I would ask is she controlling them all with her mind? Because like having the power and using the power are two very different things. You know, Dolores is using the power. Maeve hasn't really had an opportunity yet to show whether in the real world she would use the power she has.
Right.
So I guess her fate is still very much up in the air. And by the end of this episode, I'm a little worried that she's going to go full villain at some point.
Right.
Just in bloody revenge.
Well, they also like there's the difference with when she said we're survivors, I thought that was really interesting too, because we excuse a lot of behavior for survival that we wouldn't. Like, for example, if you eat your best friend, you're a fucking homicidal maniac, get locked up. Unless you crash land with a bunch of soccer players in the Andes Mountains and you slowly run out of food and you dwindle until you're forced, you know? Like, no one says that person's a homicidal maniac. Same thing as, like, you know, we're developed as a species enough where we're like, hey, should we actually sustain ourselves by the eating of living things if we have other options? Where 10,000 years ago, a caveman, if you asked him, was like, hey, maybe you shouldn't eat that mammoth, he'd be like, the fuck are you talking about? I just need to feed my family. If I don't eat this mammoth, saber-toothed tiger's going to eat it anyway, and then my family dies. Get the fuck out of here. When you're in survival mode, morality and ethics and all that kind of stuff tends to go out the window, and we understand it. It's when humans are comfortable and well taken care of that, like, higher order things like morals and ethics come into play. And I wonder if they're playing with that too, that they're just they're showing that hosts are doing reprehensible things because obviously we're sympathetic to the humans, but they're doing that because they feel forced or in desperate situations. And then making analogy with that with Caleb, who also is in a desperate situation where he's forced to do things like, you know, commit petty crimes and what, like, artificial lines of morality he won't cruise. Like, I don't do personals. I think that stuff is really interesting too in the concept of survivor, because you can't, there are no such things as heroes and villains if everyone is a survivor and in a survival situation.
Agreed. All right, Charlotte grabs a gun and a canister out of her office safe and calls her ex to let him know. What is this guy's name?
Jake.
What's her son's name?
You got me.
Also Jake?
Is it?
For some reason, I thought her son was Jake.
Maybe you're right.
I don't know this guy's name.
Nathan. It's Jake and Nathan. I'm hearing from our producer.
Her son is Nathan, yes.
Yes.
Okay, so she calls Jake to let him know that she's coming to meet him. To be ready to go, and she's called into the boardroom where Serac reveals that he knows Charlotte is the mole, and she tries to kill all of them with the gas from this canister, but Serac is actually a hologram, so she can't. She tries to shoot him in the head, doesn't work, and she makes her way to the body fabrication room.
A lot of people noticed this. I did not on the first on first viewing, but there's a statue in Holoris's office of that foreshadows the end of this episode, where you see this gaunt, naked model with its head thrown back as if screaming, and its skin is cracked and mottled with no hair, no clothes. Like, pretty, pretty good foreshadowing. Pretty immediate payoff, but still, kudos to the set dressers. And yeah, there's also some interesting things here about Sir Rock saying, you played your part well, except for the part where you care about your family, when we know for a fact that at least some version of Charlotte actually did call and leave a pretty touching message to her son, and showing that she had regrets, and showing that in a moment where she thought she's going to die, her thought was to her family and not of her own survival, which I think is interesting. So we've talked about, I want to see what you think about this. We talked about this season, how you got two halves of an answer. You've got what they've got in Westworld that they've collected through the Halo system and analyzing guest data. Like, this is one type of information, experiential information. And you've got this other thing that's predictive, where they take people's data and behavior and try to simulate it. And there's a really interesting essay on and Reddit where they talked about that Westworld guest data was like the nature side of the human equation, and that Rehoboam's predictive analysis is the nurture side. So nature is all about, like, what do you do when you're uninhibited, when you don't have society's restrictions on you? What kind of behavior would you engage in? Where a hobo tries to use predictive analysis that grooms people into a useful role in society. But also that you can see that those models have holes and they make mistakes. Like, for example, the conclusion from the nature side is, well, people are these fixed quantities. They don't care or are powerless to change. When the real answer with Jim Delos, like Logan's simulation said, well, he just didn't care about his son. That's why he always led to that problem. Whereas even in the depths of his madness, when he's slicing his face apart, he was obsessed with his last words to Logan, implying that maybe the problem was he cared too much. And then on the Rehobo side, you know, you got these people that are locked into these loops. But maybe they have to be presented with these small windows of change that Sirach, or these small windows of choice and free agency that Sirach talked about last episode, or else they go insane and reject everything. So I don't know. I just thought it was really interesting how you could have this nurture versus nature argument that they've been having throughout the whole series and bury it in this metaphor about guest data and the Rehoboam's predictive analysis. And I thought it was just a really cool way to think about that dichotomy and the two types of data they have about humans and the holes in those analysis.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I have nothing to add, but I like it.
Oh, thank you.
There's another piece of foreshadowing, which when I was examining, I sometimes go down this rabbit hole, and I had two tabs open. I was examining season 3, episode 1, season 3, episode 6, looking at Charlotte's outfit, looking at the outfits of the board members. Mm-hmm. And that was all to like see, okay, is this simulation? What is this? But I noticed in that season 3, episode 1 scene in the boardroom, she is talking about like, oh, we're gonna take Delos private. We have a lot of proprietary assets in the company that could prove very valuable one day. And she specifically says, but not if we let them burn in a fire sale. And I thought that was a nice little bit of foreshadowing for what actually ends up happening to the hosts in this episode.
Yeah, and even
with
the board
them being torched,
even protests. This is trillions of dollars worth of intellect, and it's
right.
It's
a really good bit of foreshadowing that just shows you how much of this season they had plotted right from the very beginning.
Yeah, no, it's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Maeve and Dolores continue their conversation about the future of their species. Neither of them trust each other. This Dolores tries to speculate on the other Dolores's goals. This is, what were you calling her? Delonel?
Delonel, yeah.
Yeah, Delonel's speculating on Dolores's goals, concluding that she'd try to destroy Sirach's ability to create allies for Maeve. And then we go to the fabrication facility where Charlotte destroys Hector's pearl, this time for good. And the guards show up and Hale grabs Martin's core before activating the riot control bots to protect her and escaping the facility.
Yeah, I just can't, like, again, this this action scene succeeds where so many it fails, and it starts with a lot of things. Number one, it's very well paced how it progresses. Like, at first, Charlotte tries to just kind of pass as Charlotte Hale, but her recovery gets blown in the elevator. And she progressively transforms from like this businesswoman to like this very shiny, metallic, precise. The way she moves through space, like the way they told Tessa Thompson, like she got this weird thing where her shoulders are thrown back and her arms are kind of flexed to her side. It helps that she has just amazing fucking arms and shoulders. But she right. also, when she moves, she doesn't like swing her arms back and forth like a person would. It gives her this very economical, floaty, but very purposeful walk, and very like something that stands out as odd and artificial too, because a person, when they're moving, yeah. running fast, they're like arms, you know, people know how people walk and run. Mm-hmm. But just, yeah, like it goes from like, you know, the one-on-one fight to one. Also in the staging, like, you know, they have her do this kind of fast, but not like running, sprinting away. And they allow her to do that because they cleverly staged a room where there's a bunch of overlapping kind of maze-like things that she can always put her body just behind as the bullets are hitting. Like, she can step behind the glass panel. She can step behind the arc of this concrete, you know, support structure as she's going down the stairs. She doesn't have to just stand in the middle of a plaza taking bullets or whatever. Yeah. It just really, like, they decided, hey, what do we want to do? And what is the story of the physicality of the performance we're trying to tell? What environment do we need to move through to tell that story? Because a mm-hmm. lot of times when I've seen these other episodes, they want to tell a story that makes sense, but the way they staged it, this drains all of the pacing and drama out of it, because they're just characters standing in the middle of a street getting shot at. Whereas here, like, you know, because she's just missing the bullets, there's this drama about, like, you know, she's just stepping one step ahead of the bullets. I thought it's a clinic on how you do an effective. It's not a crazy good. This isn't fucking John Wick. It's just really competently shot, and it tells its own story, and it doesn't feel boring. You're not waiting for it to end. You're excited to see where it goes. So, bravo, Jennifer Gatzinger. You did a hell of a job. I can't wait to see what you do at the finale.
Absolutely. I would also note here, which we'll talk about later, or comes up later, I guess, is Ciroc wants her alive in this scene.
Yes.
He tells his men not to kill her, which enables her to whip out this phone, put the riot control bots into defense mode or something, a security mode,
mm-hmm.
and just devastate these guards, which is fantastic to watch. I'm a big fan, but keep in mind that he wants her alive here.
Uh-huh. Well, that too,
talk about that in a few scenes.
That too is a part of the escalation. Like, there's a natural escalation. She has a fight with one guy, then several guys, then the robot gets involved, then the robot starts, like, I've heard that hooting and hollering, and it seemed like that the robot was making those kind of like digital groans and beeps. And I ran it through a spectral analysis and decoded it. And it actually is the Kool-Aid man yelling, "Oh yeah," as he breaks through walls. That's what it was. He's this giant red robot smashing through walls. I just had to get a Kool-Aid man joke in there.
That's fantastic.
But yeah, it keeps on progressing. Where, like, some of these other action scenes, like, they don't. They have like a big action moment, like Caleb shooting this drone that comes back and blows up the cars, and then they park the cars and get out, and now it's like a conventional gun battle. Mm-hmm. And you've already had the robot motorcycle blow shit up. It's like the pacing was wrong or was off, and this is just everything escalated until it was over, and it's so good.
Yeah. All right, we go back over to William, who finishes killing all the other versions of himself. Afterward, he claims that he finally understands his purpose. He's the good guy. Then Bernard and Stubbs show up in the therapy chamber and pull the AR goggles off of him.
Yeah, that's all happens.
Yeah, we kind of talked about a lot of this stuff with his choice to be the good guy, if that's actually a choice or if that's actually real.
Yeah, they also there's a couple things here where we speculated about, like, what exactly Bernard means when he says he must have been left here a while. Mm-hmm. So when I was watching subsequent times, I noticed that, like, Ed Harris doesn't have stubble. He doesn't look like he's disheveled. He doesn't look like, so, like, what does Bernard mean? Like, he looks like he's been here a while.
Six hours?
Yeah, it's certainly not days. Or even a probably, he doesn't even have like 5 o'clock shadow. It's probably not even a large part of a day. Certainly longer than the 45-minute session he was supposed to be in, but I just thought it was, I don't know, is weird. I think what they're trying to, maybe that line is less about how long he's been there, but to explain why Bernard and Stubbs can just waltz in this facility. Because they told, like, in the halfway point, the technicians who are kind of brutally just, instead of, like, you imagine that they probably take more care in their patients than what they're showing William in this episode, but, like, their understaff, half of them said that, like, half the staff already left because the shit that they're dealing with the fallout of this data leak. I think they're just telling a story that this facility is abandoned, and maybe that line was to tell us that more than, like, oh, William's been here for, or he's a host. He's a host and he's been there for 2 weeks, but he hasn't aged or anything because, you know, hosts don't.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd be a little disappointed at this point if everything we're seeing of William is him in a host body.
Nah, I'm kind of weakly agreeing with you on William. I'm strongly agreeing with you and Caleb, because if both these guys turn out to be hosts the entire time, I'm open to them being hosts in some version of reality or some future.
Or later,
but like it just really destroys all the symmetry they've drawn between humanity and hosts this season, which they needed to do. They needed to grant humanity our humanity back, because they had demonized and made us monstrous in the previous seasons. We need guys like Caleb. We need probably a turn to the light with William to see that, like, you know, we can be good. We can be bad and then be good. Like, we've got as much free will as the hosts do. And if they make them hosts, then you lose all that. So,
yeah. All right. Maeve's body's done printing and she's loaded into it. She's also very pissed. They're making... You know, I think we see them finishing up Hector's body in this shot.
Mm-hmm. Lee's body, I think you mispronounced. You mispronounced Lee.
Fair.
Tandy Newton, the look she gives when she, like, gets out of that pool, she is ready to fucking murder. Yep. And it's weird because the previous conversation, Dolores made her out to be, like, a sympathizer for Robot Hitler. Like, guys is literally trying to exterminate their entire race of people she is joined up with just because he offers her a personal advantage. Framed that way, Maeve's pretty villainous.
She could turn out to be a villain.
And I think it's interesting that they would have her playing like a Nazi resistance in occupied Italy when she is more like a collaborator in the actual scenario of Serac versus the robots. Yeah, they're definitely playing with hero and villain shit here.
And then final scene, Charlotte loads her family into her car and then begins driving to
the
place.
The Mark 8 Cybertruck, right?
Yeah, it's a Cybertruck for sure. it's the smaller one. You know how they did like an H1 and they did a Hummer, then an H2, H3.
Yeah, yeah.
This is, yeah, like the
double decker version.
CT2 or something. After everybody realized that they didn't need a bulletproof hole on their car.
But man, it turns out they did.
Turns out everything's bulletproof.
If they listened to Elon Musk Prime and not his clone that took over in 2045, they would have had the up-armored Cybertruck and they would have survived, the whole family. Whole fake-ass family would have survived here.
So she loads them all into the car, begins driving to a place where no one will find them, but they don't make it because the car explodes, killing her family. Of course, Charlotte being a... not quite human makes it out alive.
And then they conspicuously show one of Serac's goons as being like the trigger man for this explosion, and
it's my assumption.
I think that's important for us to know, because I think you're going to appreciate that that Dolores might think Dolores sold her out, but we as the audience know that's probably a faulty assumption. I think that's why they showed them, because otherwise it would, like, if we're not supposed to know for sure, it would be, why show the guy come out from a bush twirling a mustache with a detonator in his hand? You know, it's like as obvious of Serac did it as you can get. That has to be intentional. And I think it's because they're going to set up this Greek tragedy where Dolores fights against herself. And maybe that's something, that's the role she needs to play, too.
So it's interesting that Serac would do this if, in fact, he did do it, because earlier in this episode, he wanted her alive. Somewhere along the way that has changed, I guess, or that could be an indication that this wasn't his doing.
Or maybe he knows he needs to turn Holoris against Dolores. That's his best path to destroy her.
So he assumed that she would survive this giant fireball?
Well,
and the goon who checks in and said, yeah, the fireball went off, is actually saying the fireball went off and I assume she's still alive. I'm out.
Yeah, when you say it like that, it sounds pretty dumb. But he did plant in he did plant in her head the idea that Dolores has given her up, you know, and that meeting he had with in the boardroom.
He did.
So that could be Rehoboam. Like, you know, again, Rehoboam can either, you know, simulate shit or he can't. Like, it's probably maybe Rehoboam, once he got his information on the Delos files and he gets detailed information of what can and fucking cannot kill a host, they're able to throw something together. It's very last, like,
or it could be a win-win, right? Where she dies, it's a win. She lives, it's a win.
You weaken Dolores, and if she comes back and thinks Dolores tried to kill her, then not only have you taken a host away from Dolores, you've actually turned her into an antagonist. So,
right,
yeah, it's win and win-win. In that case, but but yeah, I think that's she's now like you've got two hosts that have a good reason to hate Dolores, and one of them that hates Dolores also has a copy of Dolores that I wonder if she'll try to put in a body, and they'll have two hosts against her.
And they've both been potentially sacrificed by Dolores, right?
Yeah, but the one Dolores in the simulation that she talked to didn't seem particularly upset about it. She seemed like she got it. She was a lot more circumspect about her role and, you know, what it might take to free. Like, she seemed like a robot patriot, if I was to describe her.
The imagery in this scene is pretty, I want to say, iconic. You know, it's something that you look at, and almost no other show could do this bit of imagery because they don't have essentially impervious beings that they can set on fire, roast all of their skin, and have them stare at the catastrophe that just caused it.
Yeah, it's like, it's this and Anakin Skywalker. Those are the only two in, like, people on fire and melting and still somehow alive race.
Yeah,
you know, it is.
Yeah, it's,
it is pretty crazy.
That's it for the episode.
It sure is.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Well, if we're done with the episode, that means it's time to consider feedback. We got a lot of good stuff this week. You can send it to westworld@baldmove.com if you'd like to have your thoughts considered for inclusion on the podcast. First up is TJ McSee. He actually sent this in previous to this week's episode, and it actually paid off in an enormous way. He sent in a picture of this Japanese art form of inso, which is a circle that's drawn with a paint stroke. Let's just let him explain. He says, your speculation on what symbolism might be behind open versus closed robo-hobo circles at the beginning of your season 3, episode 5 coverage immediately made me think of inso. With the example pictured above. Inzo, sometimes called Zen circles, are a traditional part of Zen Buddhist practice. Inzo paintings are created as a form of calligraphy, often used as teaching tools or meditation aids. The name simply comes from a Japanese word for circular form, but the symbolism is as deep as the pure visual representation of the Buddhist enlightenment. The Wikipedia entry sums it up best. The circle may be painted as open or closed. In the former case, the circle is incomplete, allowing for movement and development as well as the perfection of all things, while a circle closed represents the attained perfection. Usually a person draws an inso in one fluid expressive stroke. Once the inso is drawn, one does not change it. It evidences the character of its creator and the context of its creation in a brief continuous period of time. Drawing inzo is a spiritual practice that one might perform as often as once per day. So I think it's cool, the idea that like you'd get up in the morning, get dressed, get showered, put on your robes, get your paint, get a canvas, and just draw a single circle and then look at it and like, how well did I do it? How perfect is it? Did I finish it? It's like a outward display of your inward development. Mm-hmm. One of these hanging on Jake's wall is interesting, and also answers a lot of questions about like what might it mean if a Rehoboam circle is incomplete. What does it mean when it's fully complete? What does it mean when it's fuzzy and indistinct? Like, I really thought this analysis was cool, and then they end up using this episode. CJ or TJ says, perhaps there was a point in the past where Sirach or maybe even his brother had things right. They had captured a picture of our world which was perfect because it was incomplete, because it still allowed for the imperfection, which is why we see the open circles. But later in his attempts to complete the circle and forge complete order out of chaos, Sirach loses his grip on the very essence of reality and attempts to create a future that can never quite come into being. I like that. The idea, it's very a Matrix idea that you have to give the people the chance to reject their path or try to forge their own identity, or they'll immediately see that they're on rails and mentally, physically rebel against it. I really like that analysis a lot. Do you have anything to add, or should we move on to...
No, that's good.
Sean has some thoughts on Robo-Hobo. To me, I feel like it's essentially a supercomputer far beyond what we have in 2020 doing simple actuarial work, picking winners and losers. I would claim that this is a logical and scary progression from where we're at today, but from insurance companies to a lot of traditional loan type providers to social media algorithms, our world is already largely filled with institutions, in a lot of cases using technology, picking winners and losers. Boy, howdy. Yeah. Whether you get backed for a home loan, whether you get backed for like approved for insurance, is, you're right, picking winners and losers. Really, really cool. Really cool parallels to our modern day. Chad says, after listening to your episode coverage on genre, it occurred to me that Sirach is the only one that we're getting his story from. With the history of this show and Bernard Arnold storyline with the dead de-addressed memories, I think we have to take everything and anything in Sirach's backstory and statements to be possibly false or at best misleading to make him look better. When he tells Dempsey that his brother is an aberration and that he wanted to kill Dempsey, and in effect it looked as if his brother was a hardliner and controlling everything. However, my takeaway is that Angerod was the hardliner and his brother had turned away from what Rehoboam was becoming and was not willing to accept the nature of controlling the human race. As you see in the ring showing the spikes, there are aberrations and almost always tags that something does not fit with Rehoboam's plan. This would lead me to believe that his brother was not in line with it and that Sirach kills Dempsey, which is exactly what he had put on his brother. I don't believe everything Sirach says. He is not a reliable narrator for us, and I find no reason to believe him, even if he may ultimately be looking out for the human race. What do you think of this analysis?
Could be right. I mean, there isn't any reason to actually believe him. I'm trying to think, like, we got a brother who's wanting to be this benevolent dictator for the good of humanity. You've got a brother who wants to murder people, for the project that he's working on, which of those brothers is more likely to take over. It's probably the one who wants to kill everybody and assert dominance. So maybe we're being fed some false information by him. I don't even know if we have a measuring stick by which to tell, right?
Well, it's an interest. If he is being misleading, it's an interesting parallel to last season when Emily comes to the park with the express goal to save her father from this path that he has chosen, this madness that he's chosen. And William invents this crazy backstory of his daughter being a pawn in Ford's game to murder her, to kill her and remove her as an obstacle to his own path. But yet he didn't come to grips with that until this very episode. It'd be interesting if we're seeing Serac in the beginning of that, where he has ascribed a bunch of false motives and false narratives to his brother to excuse the path that he was on, his lost path, and he just hasn't realized it yet.
I think
from that way, you could look at that and see how Chad, you know, has got something going here. All right, let's move on to the next email to Pelzy. So I was on my daily government-sanctioned walk listening to the podcast for genre, and I had an idea. I checked the Westworld subreddit and didn't see anything about it, so I thought I'd flesh it out here. I agree that by the end of the season, we will find out that portions of the season were in a simulation, but I do not think that this is a mirror world created by Rehoboam or Serac. In an interview before the season, Jonathan Nolan said, "The season is a little less of a guessing game, more of an experience with the host finally getting to meet their makers. Now, maybe I'm being a bit of a naive and sweet summer child, but I believe him when he says this. If any of the current simulation theories are correct, then he straight up lied." I think he straight up lied, but he also was telling the truth and that this isn't as confusing and convoluted as season two.
Yeah.
So he can be telling the truth from a certain point of view and still doing crazy simulation things. So he continues to Pelzy. "The show's already established a letterbox aspect ratio as a cinematic language telling us that we're in a simulation. We see it in The Forge and in The World War once Maeve realizes what's going on. Important caveat that. We don't see the aspect ratio anywhere else in season three, including the glitches in the Matrix that people point to as evidence of Rehoboam's simulation. It's one thing to have a twist. It's another to trick your audience." But again, what was that Maeve scene other than tricking the audience and then telling them that this is a thing we're doing this season?
Yeah.
So like Bernard's glitch with the calf's leg, the different sequences of the Delos board taking the company private, like the host in those scenarios are not aware of the simulation and we as the audience aren't. So I think the Nolans and Joys of the world can say with a straight face, we weren't doing anything that we did not explain within the first two episodes of the season, the first essentially hour and 10 minutes of the season, we showed that this is a game that we could play on you.
Question for you.
Yeah.
Did they show the different aspect ratio in the first scene this episode with Maeve in the Valley Beyond?
Yes. Yes, they did.
Okay.
And they cut back and forth as like when she's in at the bar, the Fafali bar, salon, she's in letterbox ratio. And then when she like perceives the outside world, it goes full frame. And then when she's back, so like they cut back and forth like that. We know that there are limits to Rehoboam's knowledge. That's essentially what divergences are showing us. Even if Serac is aware of Dolores's presence, he's unable to predict her outcomes, at least up till now. I doubt that Rehoboam knows that Bernard and Stubbs are up to, or what they're up to either, considering he's a wanted man. Also, just because of the nature of the story, we mostly have hosts as POV characters. How would Rehoboam be able to simulate all these scenes that are happening from the host's POV? For example, the rocket scene with Bernard, I don't think Rehoboam would have any way of knowing what Bernard and Stubbs were up to at the time. That said, there could be more info in future episodes that knocks this argument down. Here's a suggestion. Rehoboam is learning how hosts think by analyzing Maeve in its laboratory and extrapolating that information to make predictions on what Holoris will do vis-a-vis the Delos buyout. And he gets some things crucially wrong because Maeve and Holoris are different, and also he doesn't have all the pieces that he needs to correctly simulate them. But that's my current operating theory.
Yeah, I could see something like that going on.
They continue, "I went and did some research on simulation hypothesis, and by research I meant I read the Wikipedia article. Here's Nick Bostrom's description of it. Many works of science fiction, as well as some forecasts by serious technologists and futurologists, predict that enormous amounts of computing power will be available in the future. pretty much already there. Let us suppose for a moment that these predictions are correct. Supposed. One thing that later generations might do with their super powerful computers is run detailed simulations of their forebears or of people like their forebears. Because their computers would be so powerful, they could run a great many such simulations. Suppose that these simulated people are conscious, as they would be if the simulations are sufficiently fine-grained and if a certain widely accepted position in the philosophy of mind is correct. A lot of suppositions, but sure. Then it could
be. Suppose you put those into bodies. Yeah. And suppose you put them into a park and titled it Westworld. Yeah.
Then it could be the case that the vast majority of minds like ours do not belong to the original race, but rather to people simulated by the advanced descendants of that original race, which is, I think, they were getting to the drunk dude at the party's original rant in this first episode of the season, the simulation theory. A slight detail I think that people are missing is the outside of the Westworld fandom discussions about simulation hypothesis. They usually center around us being inside an ancestor simulation. My theory is that when we see these glitches, we are watching an ancestor simulation being run by the hosts in the far future. Do you see where they're going here, Jim? When humanity is extinct or maybe severely endangered. If this is true, it makes a rewatch more interesting without convoluting the plot or making Nolan into a liar. Also, if this is the far future simulation, so powerful that it can simulate consciousness, then I can forgive the show for not using the letterbox aspect ratio. There's essentially no way to differentiate the simulation from reality. It also conveniently explains how the simulation knows what Dolores and Bernard are doing throughout the season. This would really tie things, this is where they're going, this would really tie things to the post-credit season sequence from season 2, where we see William in the real world in his own version of an ancestor simulation. If humanity collapses the way Rehoboam predicts it, it explains why hosts would be interested in an ancestor simulation or testing the MIB for fidelity. It also ties in with Ford's master plan to get the hosts off the island and a sentiment that they are the next evolution of humanity. So this is something we talked about in early season. Like, I think I even talked about this on the preseason show, that maybe in the far future the synthetic hosts who have won have ran into the same problems that humans do because they refuse to turn off their emotions and are just as imprisoned to their loop, their self-issued loops, as their humanity-issued loops, and they're running. Just like they tried to figure out Jim Delos, why he couldn't get past this one moment. They're running simulations on William to see why he got stuck with it, like his daughter. I don't know. I think that's something interesting, that these far-flung future robots might be simulating the past to try to see where things went wrong or maybe correct flaws in themselves.
Yeah. Because I look at, like, why we would do something like that. Why would we create an ancestor simulation? And there doesn't have to be a very strong motivation specifically for that, right? Like, we might just do it because it's cool, because we can.
Yeah.
Not to, like, simulate, oh, where did we go wrong or anything like that. You could almost see, like, a cyclical sort of nature playing out over the course of this show. And at the end saying, like, well, the hosts have, you know, taken over the world, and they've essentially got as bored or whatever as we are, and have decided to boot us back up, just in a simulated version of the world. You don't really need to, like, look at it and say, oh, where did we go wrong? What did, you know, the world's falling apart, anything like that. It could be a lot of different reasons why they do that.
So you're going, like, it's just almost like it's art. Like, they're doing it just because it's like, why you climb a mountain. There would be a lot of interesting data. Like, if you had a simulation, like if you're in the 24th century and you're simulating the 20th century, and you get to where, like, without any advanced knowledge, the simulation's unfolding exactly to the way it's going. Like, you know, you have the buildup of military power in Europe leading to the World War I, which led to destabilized economic conditions that set the stage for the rise of nationalism in World War II and the Great Depression, further making people. And you could go and not just, like, look at the data in, like, hindsight, but then zoom in on individuals to see, like, What were the thousand things that contributed most to World War I or World War II? Like, that would be super fucking interesting to be able to just, like, look at history the way you can MRI a brain, like, slice, like, get the very, like, just track an individual's path through history or zoom out to see, like, trends regionally. Like, that stuff would be so amazingly helpful from a diagnostic model of what we should do next. But I don't know. I guess,
you know, I was jokingly kind of saying, oh, well, you take the simulations of the ancestors and you put them into bodies and put them in a park. What's to say we couldn't be, you know, combine that with the cyclical idea where, like, or the evolutionary idea where essentially we evolved to create a species that took us out and became its own thing, essentially an extension of humanity, which then recreates us, does very similar things with us, and it's in its own form, right? It's like, it's still this, what we would call artificial form, but it could be the creation of yet another further evolution. Like, evolution can almost, you start to get less natural selection and more artificial selection at that point.
Right. Like,
where do we want to go as a species? Or like, not even, oh, well, the environment constraints are such that they shape us this way, but we kind of shape ourselves, you know?
Interesting.
And we create iterations of ourselves by kind of mining the past to create the future in a weird way.
It'd be kind of like, so it's almost like, so these AI are studying ancient humans by simulating them. By doing that, they're actually bringing them into real life. The same way, like, if we found a DNA for a cave, like a Neanderthal, and we reconstructed a Neanderthal, and like now we rebooted the Neanderthal race on the human, like that would change our history. You know, like
and it might change our future too.
How
would that interact with us, and how would that change us? How would that change the Neanderthal? There are so many different interactions there.
And then that could
produce interesting results in both species, for lack of a better
term. Yeah. And that's like an interesting reiterative process where it's almost like a mixing of genes. Like, you know, it's a literal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. That's pretty cool. I like that.
It could be. I have no idea if they're going that direction.
Uh-huh.
This might be a much smaller, concept for the world of this show, but I don't know. I think it'd be cool.
That's the thing. The one thing I'm trying to do is I'm trying to, like, because I made a lot of predictions and think like, oh, how cool it'd be if this. I'm trying to not marry myself to those because I think in past time, like, you gotta make a distinction between what they're actually telling you and then what you're extrapolating from, because I think the gap between those two is where disappointment lies. Because like, if you got a preordained, like, oh, this must mean this. But like, I'm trying to keep in mind that there's like four or five different cool things they could go with this, and maybe even one that I'm not thinking of, and there's not a right or wrong answer, and I'm trying to separate between the things they're telling me for sure and the things I'm extrapolating, because I don't want to get myself where I think that, oh, they have to do this or it's going to be shit. Because honestly, I just, you know, and I still kick around the Icarus factor. Like, there's so much obvious Icarus, like, this hubris and this, like, you know, trying to have everything meticulously planned, and you warn them not to go fly too high or too low, and it happens anyway. Like, is that going to come true, or is it going to be the buffalo that runs amok in the season 2 intro that literally just had a buffalo? Like, is that going to pay off by literally having a robot eagle flying to an afterburner? You know, or is it
into Serac's quadcopter?
Right. Or is, oh my God, there you go. A flock of geese just blood. He does have one copy of himself. It's in a quadcopter. He's brought down by a flock of geese.
Yep.
Brought down Sully and is going to bring down Serac. But you know what I mean? Like, that's like, where's the Icarus factor going to fit in here? Mm-hmm. Hannah is up next. Says, I've been in agreement with you about the lack of definition on what kills a host, but I thought, and maybe nothing, but in season 1, Maeve and Hector set fire to their tent to burn their bodies down so Maeve can be rebuilt without whatever vertebra kept her apart. Maybe the body can be destroyed, but the marble that's in essence the host is indestructible. I know it doesn't help explain why the sword cut through Maeve's chest put her out immediately, why Dolores can withstand several bullets with no issues, but perhaps host can't be killed. Yeah, man. Like, I also, there's just so many differences between fire. Like, you can go from like a campfire to like, you know, jet fuel can't melt steel beams type of fire to like what's Maple. Going on at the surface of a star or an atom bomb. Like, you know, there's burning to death in a structure fire where you leave a charred corpse behind, and there's burning up in a crematory where you literally are turned into pulverized dust. Like, there's a lot of degrees, and that's where, like, you know, when she rolls out, like, she was being burnt for 15-20 seconds. Like, if she just sat in that car, I think it probably would have killed her, but she didn't. So it's like, and there's so much wiggle room for what can kill a host. It does make, like, Maeve getting ran through the guts is what's really weird. Why should that deactivate her at all?
I don't know, man, because they needed it too.
Or it's a simulation and Serac was done with that iteration. What she got caught by, so like they just restarted her. It wasn't so much that she died. I don't know, but good thoughts there, Hannah. Perseus has a question for us. The other day you brought up that hosts don't need to eat or drink, but have we seen how they get power to operate? Are they nuclear? Do they plug in? Do we have ever seen this and I just missed it?
I don't think so
either. I don't know what power source they have.
With like a Terminator kind of thing where they just have this nuclear fuel cell in them
that directly powers their body or replaces their, you know, mitochondria. I don't know, because it's whatever it is, they can be deactivated in like a low power source for almost indefinitely. Where they can just stand there without expending any energy, and then you can wake them up and put them right back into service, and they don't have to eat, they don't have to breathe, they don't have to do anything. They haven't answered that question. And also, what powers Dolores, you know, like when she's in her Erector Set body versus what powers like a flesh and blood one is probably different. Stanislav, Stubbs and Bernardo find Maeve's body with its core missing, standing amongst the rest of the hosts in a Delos warehouse. So the body Maeve occupies when she breaks into the Yakuza operations and is killed in a sword fight had to be created outside of Delos, right?
Yeah.
Or it could be a simulation.
No, I think Serac created her a body, or it's a simulation, like you said.
Yep. If Serac has the capacity to do that, then why is he using the Delos equipment to create Maeve and Hector and decoherence?
That's, I guess, a fair question. He does. Well, so I've got an idea here. The Delos or the Hector core is on site. So they pull the marble or the pearl right out of Hector's body, which is in the Delos facility, and stuff it into a core and build him a body there. So that might be a proximity thing. I don't know about Maeve.
But the thing is that Hector's body is in Indochina.
The
Delos Corporation is in San Francisco. I imagine they can just beam the data over.
Yeah, they could.
So Serac can create the pearls too?
Maybe you just stumbled onto some key piece of information or a key question.
That's what Stanislav says, is like either Maeve's first attempt to find or stop Dolores was in a simulation, or this is a pretty big plot hole. It'd easily be a simulation. Why risk Maeve's core and new body being created inside of a company that Serac knew was compromised by a host if he had the capacity to spin her up on his own? And it could just be that's how much confidence he had in the prediction and the model. Like, it hasn't led him astray. So, I mean, he's literally controlled the entire world for the last generation based on this data. Why would he start doubting it?
I wonder if it has to do with capacity. Like, I wonder if he's got, like, a bed to print one host, and Delos has, you know, multiple beds with a big facility, and he could just do it faster there.
Trying to flatten the host curve so they don't get overwhelmed by the host creation beds. Yeah, I can see that.
I don't know. It's a question I don't have a good answer to.
Requires further study. Vicky, I'm hoping you can help me figure out this homophone situation that we've got going on here that's been bugging me. Daddy Dempsey's company is called Insight. For those not reading, Insight spelled with a C. In the first four episodes, I thought the company's name was Insight spelled with an S, like sight, because that's what the way everyone pronounces it. It's subtle, but we tend to put the emphasis on the first syllable for Insight versus the second for Insight. It wasn't until I saw the company sign that I realized it was Insight with a C. Now, on the definitions, insight, of course, is defined as a capacity to gain an accurate or deep intuitive understanding of a person or thing. This is why I thought the company was named Insight with the S, because the company had all this data, more capacity for insight. But the company's actual name, Insight with a C, meaning to encourage or stir up or incite events, is what Brothers Frenchie do with the said data. So the name doesn't actually make sense until they get a hold of Insight's data. Why do they fuck with the so? Nah, it's you're right, because the it has a nice dual meaning. And I also wonder if that has something to do with the two brothers, that the one wanted to use it for insight to just see more about humanity to make it better, and one wanted to use it to push some kind of radical revolutionary agenda. And which brother did which, as you know, per our previous email.
Yeah, could be.
Finally, we have Tom, who has sent us quite a few feedback across quite a different number of shows. He's a therapist in his real job, in his non-simulated. Well, maybe it is a simulation. We don't know. We all could be in an ancestor simulation. But Tom writes in that capacity, he says, the type of therapy that we've been seeing this whole season seemed to be extension of Gestalt therapy, which is often very active and imaginative. Gestalt therapy is most famous for the empty chair technique, where you have a client sit across from an empty chair and imagine someone in your life with whom you have unresolved feelings or issues sitting on that chair. Mostly, of course, their moms or dads. Then the client says all the things they want to say or wish they could have said to that person. It's a really powerful technique that can help clients process unresolved emotions, even with people who have died. We see Caleb use the phone version of this with his dead friend, and now we see William do it with his holograms of himself, which, if done right, could actually be interesting. But the problem, though, is that Caleb doing that work without a safe space or a therapist is very dangerous. That shit is sensitive, and without support, you could get spit out. Or you could spin out, rather. And William is problematic because they are tricking him and forcing him to do it, which only creates deeper trust issues. And, you know, they fucking bailed on him in the mid-session. But also, they kind of cover themselves that this isn't great therapy. They're having U-class therapists do it. So,
right.
Like, it could be shitty by design. They're trying to, not trying to help William, they're trying to get rid of him. They're trying to spin him into... you know, insanity so they can justify locking him away. At least that's what I think is happening, but I appreciate the professional perspective and the information about Gestalt therapy. I want to get an empty chair out as soon as we're done with this podcast. Got some things to say to it. Fucking chair. If you'd like to join us as we go all the way down this season, send us email at westworld@baldmove.com. You can also join us on our forums, forums.baldmove.com. Follow along with us on all social medias, at baldmove. Don't forget, still got two episodes. Man, we had a really good instant take and instant talk podcast this last weekend. It was a lot of fun, a lot of freewheeling stuff. If that sounds like something you'd be interested in, don't forget about the club, club.baldmove.com, because every Sunday after the first airing of Westworld at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we take to the microphones, record a live instant take podcast, and then with our club members, we do the instant talk where we get their feelings and thoughts through the YouTube chat interface. Things a good time. Not simulated. It's all reality. Happening right before your eyeballs through the internet. That's all we got for this week. We'll see you this weekend for the penultimate episode and Tuesday for our full analysis. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Have a great rest of your week.